there's always reason to celebrate. Y'all agree with that? There's always reason to celebrate. It's occurred to me that whenever we fail, which regrettably is far too often, even if we fail seriously, there's reason to celebrate forgiveness. Whenever we're troubled and confused, there's reason to celebrate God's sovereignty and His goodness. Whenever good things happen, we can celebrate His blessing. Whenever bad things happen, we can celebrate hope. Whenever relationships work, we can celebrate joy. When we love, we can celebrate life. There really is reason to celebrate, and I want us very much, as we go through this week, to, in the middle of all the heaviness, in the middle of all the exploration, in the middle of all the struggling that weeks like this precipitate, in the middle of all the hard things, I'd like to remind myself, and you along with me, that there's always reason for celebration. And because of that, can we sing a hymn as we start tonight? Stand with me. Let's sing "To God Be the Glory." Last night I talked about my concerns with the idea of a model. The word "model" I don't think is a bad word. I'm sure we'll continue to use it. But I have concerns with it that I expressed last night. And let me summarize, maybe as clearly as I know how, in just a phrase, my major concern with the idea of model. The idea of model is too restrictive. The idea of model is too restrictive of me. And it's too restrictive of you. When you sit down to talk with somebody, if what's in your mind is trying to follow a model, they're not getting you. They're not getting what's powerful that you, that I, have to offer. A model has a place. There's room for thought, and guidance is helpful, and categories for thinking. We've stressed a lot in our teaching, and I'm all for that. But there's something very restrictive about a model that minimizes and sometimes, I think, eliminates the potential for power. Ask yourself this question. When have you felt really powerful? When have you felt really, really powerful in somebody else's life? Now ponder that for just a minute. We'll not take time for group discussion. But ponder it. When have you felt deeply powerful in somebody's life? Some are wondering if there's ever been a moment where you could claim that. Some are wondering if ever you know anything about Colossians 1:29, where Paul said that the energy of Christ works powerfully in him. Others of you have events in your mind. I have one that occurs to me that's recent I want to tell you about in just a minute. But you know what's striking to me? I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this thought. It just occurred to me. But you know what's striking to me? When I think about the times that I've been most powerful, it's not with my family. Do you all struggle with that? Don't you wish you could be more powerful with your kids? Aren't you so grateful when somebody else comes along and at the same time you hate them? You're grateful out of your mind, but you're wondering, why them? Why can't I have that kind of influence? What does it take to be powerful? And I'm afraid that when we overdo thinking, I'm not against thinking, obviously, I hope, but I'm afraid when we overdo thinking and develop a model that's too airtight, that something gets very restricted, that God wants to come out and move through us toward other people. Let me tell you a story to tell you what I'm talking about. I asked this at a men's seminar that I taught recently. I asked the men that were there, it was men and women, but I asked the men that were there, when's the last time you as a man have asked anybody to pray for you specifically? When's the last time you as a man have said, right now I'm at a point of such neediness, something is falling apart so badly that I desperately need you to pray for me? When's the last time you've done that? I would guess that if the 150 men in the room were each to stand up, I'd bet you a buck. Wouldn't bet you much more than that because I'm not too sure of myself, but I'd bet you a buck that of the 150 men in this room, there'd be just a handful who have ever gone to another man at a point of personal crisis and said, right now, I need you to pray for me. I can't pray, will you? I don't mean going to a guy and sharing a burden. I think there'd be more that have done that. but have actually said, will you pray for me? Why is that so hard for men? If I'm right, that is just a handful. Why is that so hard? There have been three times in my life that I've done that. And only three. That's not many. One time was I asked Dan to pray for me in the middle of a real family struggle where I was beside myself. A second time was at the advanced seminar 3 years ago, whenever it was, when I didn't want to come down and teach one more time. And I was up in my room, and the idea of coming down and facing this crowd, which usually is pretty friendly, but that didn't mean anything. I didn't want to come teach. And yet, you know, what are you going to do? Just call in sick? And I laid in the bed upstairs in the room that we always have here, and I thought, I would love more than anything else to have somebody pray for me. And I heard a voice outside my door of a good friend, and I thought, yes, God has provided Jehovah Jireh. There's the sacrificial lamb. And I hesitated. And I waited a minute, I think really, to kind of sabotage my plans to make sure he was gone before I went out to get him. Which makes a lot of sense. And then I thought, what is so hard about me asking a guy to pray? And I think part of what it is, I don't know how to put it more elegantly or more thoughtfully, I just think it's plain old pride. I think there's a whole lot of that. Maybe some other more elegant things that sound more defensible, but that's the function, by the way, of most psychological dynamics, to make bad things sound more palatable and interesting. But I didn't go out and ask him, and I thought, well, why? Why would I not do that? And then I thought of the Lord. He asked three men to pray for him, and look who he asked. Don't tell me that nobody qualifies. And look who he is asking Peter. Can you imagine God asking Peter to pray for him? I mean, that boggles the mind. When you think back on Peter, Peter's a guy, don't forget, who went to the Lord during the Lord's earthly ministry as the Lord began saying that I'm going to go die. And as Peter realized, the Lord was telling him that he was going to go die. Remember the time that Peter called him aside and said, can I have a chat with you? We can avoid that. There's a better plan. Before the foundation of the world, this was in order. And here's Peter saying, we can improve on this. And then Jesus asks him to pray for him. And I'm thinking, I'm not willing to ask somebody to pray for me? That's not good. I came down about 6:10 that night, a couple of advanced seminars ago. And there's a guy here, Bruce Boynes from South Africa, who I got to know a little bit when I was over there in South Africa. And he said to me, he walked up to me out of the blue and said, can I pray for you? Well, what do you do when God does that? No, I don't think so. I'm fine. You know, I can fake it a little longer. And I said, yes. I grabbed him back to the room and he said, will you pray first? And I said, oh, no. I'm not going to pray. I can't. You pray. He prayed for 5 minutes. It was great. Third time that I asked someone to pray for me about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Back at the, up at the campus. And I forget all the details that was happening, but I wasn't having a good day. And Al Andrews, who's here teaching one of the seminars tomorrow and is involved in the morning videos, called him in. And I remember calling him in because I wanted him to pray. It took me 30 minutes to get around to asking him. What on earth is going on with us dumb men? All you men are just like me. You poor ladies, how do you endure? Man, it's tough. That's right. That was said by a man, but I think he's a ventriloquist. It was his wife actually talking. And 3 weeks ago, or whenever it was, 4 weeks ago sometime, when I asked Al to pray, I did something I don't do. Do you all get on your knees when you pray? I don't think that's something which is required. I don't think it's more spiritual to be on your knees when you pray. But I felt compelled to fall to my knees as Al prayed. And I fell on my knees. And for whatever reason, I'm turning into a mystic here, folks. Forgive this old-time rationalist getting mystical. But for whatever reason, there was something that felt very released in me at that point. And I felt very powerful. And I didn't feel powerful because of the books that I've written. I didn't feel powerful because of the model I've put together. I didn't feel powerful because of the new charts I've come up with. I felt powerful for another reason. I'm not sure what it was. Something to do with God. The next day, you really should have been my client. Man, was I good. I had one one woman I've been working with now for 6 or 8 months. And she's a, this is a funny way to put it, but kind of a mild MPD. Well, if you work with MPDs, even mild ones, you know there's a lot of struggles there. Well, she came in, and the week before, she just was just a mess. And she sat down, and I did something that I wouldn't recommend anybody do. I'll probably never do it again as long as I live, unless I ask somebody else to pray for me someday. And she sat down, and I began by saying, I'm tired of you being crazy. I'm going to cure you today. That's what I said. Can we strike that from the tape? That'll never be in a book, I'll tell you. And she just kind of... I said, no, I'm serious. I said, no reason for this. If you've got Christ in your life, if the Holy Spirit wants you better, I can't imagine you can't make some big movement today if you're willing to stop being so darn stubborn. We had a fantastic hour. You know what happened? In large measure, she got cured that day. She came back in the next week, and her first sentence was, what was with you last week? And I said, I don't know. You know, I'm recovered. It's all right. And I said, did it help? And she said, yeah. And I said, what happened? She said, I'm not going to choose to be crazy anymore. I said, well, good for you. And she said, but now I'm kind of angry. And I said, well, that's dumb. I said, that's just, you're just trying to organize your chaos, because anger is such an organizing emotion. I said, I don't want you to do that. She said, all right. Beats me, folks. I don't explain it. I just tell it. I don't know. You all had moments like that? I've not had many. That afternoon, I worked with Ken and Joan. This is three or four weeks ago. Wish they were here to tell about it. Ken and Joan came in that afternoon after I dealt with a woman with a little bit of MPD. And they came in, and he was doing very poorly. He was struggling real bad. And he went on for about 30 minutes complaining about Joan. And after about 30 minutes, I think I had used the wasp illustration that happened maybe the day before I was with Ken, or sometime if it happened, I forget when. But I just made some comment like, the wasp walking all over you right now. And I said, you know, the way you are right now, if I needed somebody to pray for me, I'd never ask you. And my guess is that when your kids get to be 16, 18, 20, if you're the way you are today, they'll never ask you to pray. How do you feel about that, Ken? That broke his heart. And I pushed, and I pushed, and I pushed. You watched me this morning not pushing much. Schizophrenia is a requirement to be a counselor. Or at least associative. How do you teach this stuff? I haven't got a clue. I don't know how to do it either. But I pushed. And I said to him, I said, Ken, you need to ask me to pray for you. And after about 20 more minutes of pushing, he said, I want to. And I said, that's not enough. I said, you slide to your knees, and after you're on your knees, Joan and I will join you, then I'll pray. He slid to his knees. I got on mine. I prayed for about 10 minutes. We had a wonderful time. He left very helped that day, and not by me. Now, do you suppose that happens because of a model? What does that happen because of? Freedom in Christ. And once in a while, you get a taste of it. I want more. Is there room for a model? Yes, but let's not let it be restrictive. Let's somehow think about what it means to let the fullness of who Christ is in us and through us come alive for the benefit of other people. I thought about greatness a while ago, and recently, just last night, talked about it with some friends. Thought about greatness in different fields, thinking of the athletic field. Thought about three great athletes. Thought about perhaps the best tennis player that ever lived, John McEnroe. Not the most well-behaved, but the most skilled, perhaps. And if you know anything about tennis and you've watched McEnroe play, you know he doesn't play by the rules. I don't mean by the rules in terms of he doesn't play by rules of decency, but he doesn't play by normal rules of how to hit a ball either. A lot of his stuff is very unorthodox, particularly his volley. You know, one of the major rules, my son's a tennis pro, and one of the major rules that Kep talks about is that when you're at the net and you volley, the racket must be above your wrist. The racket head must be above your wrist when you hit a volley. McEnroe is always like this. Why? That's what comes to him as he plays the game, because there's something in him that is athletic genius. In golf, Jack Nicklaus is arguably the best player that ever played the game of golf. I read a story some years ago when he was in his prime, and he was playing with another pro golfer who just wasn't in Nicklaus's league, and they were in the golf course, and there was some difficult shot, and Jack hit a ball, and it kind of went around a tree and came back on the green and came within a foot of the pin. The other golfer turned to Jack and said this, "I play golf. What are you playing?" I met a few people who I wanted to say this to. I'm doing counseling, biblical counseling, I think. What are you doing? And I'm asking, looking up. Third great athlete that occurs to me is Michael Jordan. I'm a Bulls fan. Every mature Christian is a Bulls fan. It's a measure of maturity. In the playoffs a year or two ago, Phil Jackson, the coach of the Bulls, at a crucial point at the end of one major game, in a playoff game, called the timeout. And as the story goes, he said to his team the following thing, "Scotty, Pippen, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, and Horace, I want you to do this, and Johnny Paxson, I want you to do this, and Bill Cartwright, I want you to do this." He turned to Michael and he said, "Michael, just do what you do." That's what I want to say to each of us. Do what you do when you love God and know Him well. Just do what you do. And if that means sitting across from an MPD and saying, "I'm going to cure you today." Now, for goodness sakes, don't write that down as a technique of how to deal with MPDs. I'll get sued. It's terrible. I mean, don't do that. But every now and then, a touch of freedom comes. Every now and then, there's the potential for real power coming out of us. Do you know most people that counsel over a long period of time get very disillusioned with it? There's happy exceptions. But those happy exceptions, the one who over the years continue to enjoy involvement with people and continue to know God better in the middle of it, I think are the Michael Jordans, the Jack Nicklauses, and the, who else did I mention, John McEnroes. And I believe that each Christian is called to be that in the personal sphere. It isn't just the creative geniuses, those who have super gifts like a Michael Jordan. No one has Michael Jordan's basketball gifts. But we can't say, I don't think giftedness is the key issue in counseling. Chuck Smith's final message at Master's Seminary before he died, his last message he was able to give, someone told me this, I think it's true. If it wasn't his last one, it was close to the last message he ever gave. He told the seminary students at Master's this. He said, "You know, there's a very low correlation between giftedness and maturity. If you have one, you rarely have the other." That shouldn't be that way. But it is. God wants to use the gift that His Spirit sovereignly distributes, but giftedness without maturity leads to pride and leads to superficial healing, which Jeremiah condemns. Therefore, the real issue in each of our lives is not, "Well, I'm not a very gifted counselor. I don't even know how to think very well. I haven't followed a thing you guys have ever taught. You know, read your book 10 times, still can't get it. How many circles are there? You know." Folks, if you can't recall the circles, that's really all right. Well, not entirely. But I believe what matters is, are you released to jump like Michael jumps, to volley like John volleys, to hit the ball like Jack hits the ball? We as Christians have the potential to be more deeply released because God has put within me a uniqueness that nobody else has. He's put within you a uniqueness that nobody else has. And He's put His Spirit within each of us to move through that uniqueness to make a marvelous difference in a few people's lives. And I want our teaching to facilitate that. Let me review last night just for a minute. And then press on in the spirit of what I've just been talking about. Last night I talked about... Did I lose myself there? Yeah. Last night I talked about five thoughts. He's looking frustrated back there, so... Mechanical ability is worse than anybody in the world's, except Dan's. And they didn't have an engineer that day that was available, so they put me behind the console of this radio, you know, like an airplane console, and there's buttons and lights flashing, and the guy says, "You'll hear the phone ring in your earphone when Chicago's called. You just press two buttons and everything will be fine." And I was terrified, just terrified. You know, but hey, I did it and it worked. I even changed another knob that I thought looked like it made sense. You think I don't know how to take risks? Are we back okay now? Okay. Talked about five thoughts last night. I said that we're going to have problems till the day we die. Just when we think we have it together, our family is as it should be. We've gotten over some insecurities. Certain symptoms have been overcome. Something else comes along. That was my first thought. My second thought was God doesn't seem particularly committed to overcoming all the problems I want to overcome. So I presume He must have a higher agenda. He's telling a story, but it's a higher story than the one I'm telling. And He wants me to be lifted up into His story. That was my second thought. My third thought had to do with the fact that there's something wrong. That was the idea of the wasp. There's something going on beneath the surface, and you and I need to pay attention to whatever it is that's going on in our souls, not that explains our symptoms, but rather what's going on in our souls that's obstructing our vision of Christ. That's very different. Try to write a book on psychopathology with that assumption in your mind, and it'll be different than any book ever written on the topic. The fourth assumption had to do with the fact that, I don't have my notes with me, so I'm making this up. I hope it's pretty close to what last night was. Somebody that, pardon? Whatever the wasp is reveals itself most clearly in how we relate. And I talked about the fact that we must tell the story of our relationships. And the last point that I made had to do with understanding something about the process of change. And you're going to hear a lot, particularly in the mornings, about the process of change being summarizable with the two ideas of disrupt and affirm. That, by the way, comes from Jeremiah. That's where that thought occurred to me in Jeremiah, where God told Jeremiah that He wants them to tear down and rip out, and then to build up and to plant. He's talking about a building and a garden there. And He says, take that building that's already been built, and I want you to demolish it, and take all the stones that have been... Another time. It's fun to go in and out here. And take all those stones that the building was built on, and I want you to reduce them to dust. We're going to try a different way. Don't apologize, that's fine. Well, that was your problem, Jefferson. Thanks. I can handle it. Authentic manhood. Take that building and make sure all those stones are crushed until they're dust. Take that garden and rip out every plant till there's nothing left that was planted. When that's been done, I want you to build up and to plant. That's the idea of disrupt and entice and affirm. And with those five thoughts, we came up with this simple little chart last night. Come on, it's simple. Little chart last night to summarize the direction that I want to ponder with you for a bit. Starting up here with letters PP, presenting problem. That's where the process starts. You and I meet with people and we look in mirrors and meet with ourselves and realize that we have problems. Our lives present problems. We present problems as we face our lives honestly. None of us is beyond that. Problems we'll always have with us. But even before we come to our problems, there needs to be a purpose clearly fixed in our mind, and the purpose is that God is not committed to necessarily getting us over all the problems we'd like to have gotten over. What God is committed to doing, and this has to be our purpose as we approach presenting problems, our purpose has to be one of saying that I know what I'm after, and what I'm after is not primarily overcoming your problems. What I'm after more than anything else is introducing you to a deeper enjoyment of the only person in the world, in the universe, who's thoroughly enjoyable. I want you to always have reason for celebration, even when a loved one dies. I want you to have confidence in the goodness of God no matter what struggles continue. I want you to trust that He's at work no matter what's going on in your life. And I want to introduce you to Christ. That's biblical counseling. I'm not talking about conversion of an unbeliever to a believer, certainly that. But I'm talking to us as believers. None of us knows God very well at all. When we go to be with Him, we're going to learn things we haven't even dreamed of. The half has not been told. The tenth has not been told. And so our job as biblical counselors is not to solve problems. Our job as biblical counselors is to use problems as impetus to more strongly pursue God. But in doing that, we need to look beneath the problems and understand that beneath the problems, there are some issues that need to be looked at. There is a wasp. My phrase last night, my phrase tonight for the very same thing, there is a fallen structure. And I'm going to discuss that for a little bit tonight. What is the wasp exactly? What's the fallen structure? There is a fallen structure. There's something going on in the human soul that we need to get a very basic grasp on. Now listen carefully to my next few sentences here. If we don't get a clear grasp on what the fallen structure is, then all of our analysis of what's going on beneath the surface is going to be pointless, futile, and probably damaging. If we start trying to figure out what's beneath depression, what's beneath eating disorders, what's beneath homosexuality, what's beneath, you name the presenting problem, if we don't have our thinking clearly within a framework that says that whatever else may be going on, we know the core energy beneath all these other issues is something very basic called the wasp or the fallen structure. If we don't know what we're talking about there, if we don't know what the bottom line issue is, then we're going to get in a mess in all of our dynamic theorizing. We've got to be very clear on the simple idea, and it seems so simple to me, but I think Christian counselors get away from it in great ways. It seems so simple to me to say this, that the definition of life is knowing God. Jesus said that. And people want to live. I long to live, and Jesus says, I'll tell you how to live. Know me and the one who sent me. That's life. Then if I'm going to understand using these problems that people present, if I'm going to understand how to move people toward God, then I must understand what is the obstacle to knowing God. And that's where you think about the human soul in depth. And if that's your thought, then you're safe if you have that as your parameter, as you analyze and think and ponder and explore and do all this stuff and look at background factors and how fathers don't do this and how mothers did this wrong. And I'm not opposed to thinking about all that stuff, provided it's all within a framework of a saying that what we're looking for, we're diagnosing, not psychopathology, we're diagnosing obstacles to knowing God. That's the fallen structure. That's the wasp. And in order to understand that fallen structure and to see it acted out and to see what needs to be dealt with, and then in the Christian to see not only the fallen structure that needs to be disrupted, but also what God has put in the believer's heart, that new heart, the Holy Spirit dwelling within, in order to see what can be pulled out and enticed and affirmed and encouraged, in order to see what's bad that needs to be disrupted and attacked and confronted and exposed, in order to see all that, where do you look? You enter the story of the person's life primarily, and we'll look at this more thoroughly as the week goes on, but primarily the story of their present relationships. There's other stories to be told, but that's where you focus. You enter the story of how do you relate? What is your effect on people? What is your pull? And as you enter the story, you as a counselor need to have in your mind, well, how's that going to help? What does help mean? Help does not mean overcoming presenting problems. Help means finding God a little more deeply. And that was Paul's preoccupation, wasn't it? How have we gotten so far away from that? Christian counselors are to some degree at fault here. We've gotten so sensitive in the church to people's problems that we've made problems the center point. We've reacted against legalism and right-wing fundamentalism, and rightly we should react against that. Because legalism is just a matter of saying, we don't care how you feel, we don't care about your history, we just want you to be obedient and do the right thing, and that's all there is to it. I react again. It's terrible. Let's talk about people's hurts and struggles and problems. Let's be sensitive to the fact that people in our churches are hurting badly. Marriages that where couples haven't had sex in years, where all sorts of things are going on. The saints are heartbroken. Let's be compassionate and deal with that. But let's not go so far as to make problems and their solutions, the point. I'm not the point, God is. And when I understand that, my welfare is assured. Because God then will, as I get to know Him and make Him the point, what God does do, what God will do, what I believe He's promised to do, is He'll deal with all the problems in my life in a way that will release me to honor His purpose for me. But His purpose for me is different than my purpose for me. My purpose for me is, I'd like to not feel so bad. I'd like to cry a little bit less. I'd like to have fewer problems in my home. I'd like to have this. I'd like to have that. Let me come to God and get Him to do it for me. And God says, no, I'm telling a story. You become a part of it, and I'll work in your life to help you become a wonderful storyteller of the grace of God. But if becoming a wonderful storyteller requires these tribulations, then I'll bring them into your life. I'll allow them. Because I have a story in mind, and it's the only story worth telling. And as I understand the story, and as I move into your story, and I help people understand how change occurs by disruption and affirmation, then I think this provides not a model of counseling, but a framework for thinking as you move into people's lives. My suggestion is you and I need to develop some passionate convictions. Some deeply passionate convictions that come out of core parts of our souls. Convictions that are inflamed within us. Convictions that as we sit down and hear somebody tell their story, that we know what we're after. We know what our purpose is. Convictions that say, we know at the core what's going on. We have a basic idea fundamentally of what's going on in every fallen heart. We may spend time exploring to hear the details of your life, of course, but I know at core what's going on. Folks, at one level, biblical counseling theory is just not very complicated. A lot of complexity all over the place up here. In its fundamentals, what are we after? Promoting the glory of God so His story gets told. Realizing what it is in the human heart that keeps people from wanting to tell His story, keeps folks from wanting to know Him, and learning something about how to encourage deep change in a person's life so that what really is changed is not their problem, but their agenda. No longer do they want their story fixed up. They want their lives to count. That little diagram is meant, and I hope it functions this way, it's meant to be an encouragement toward freedom. You hold your tennis racket any way God leads you to. And if it violates the rule book, that's just fine. I don't mean the moral rule book. Don't misunderstand me. But when I counsel, you watched me counsel on the screen this morning, and I was very laid back, and I was very quiet and gentle, and you hear me tell my stories about how I holler and scream, and, well, I do all that and 25 other things too. And so should you. Whatever you want to do. If you know your purpose, you know what's wrong, and you know how to encourage change. If that's clear in your mind and you have deep convictions, do your thing. Take off from the foul line. You can reach the basket, dunk. It's all right. You're behind a tree. You can hit a shot that does this. Well, I cannot. Sure you can. Or, better put, God really can. He's in the business of doing pretty weird things. And He wants to do it through me. And He wants to do it through you. Something gets in the way of honoring all this. If all this is making any sense, and you're encouraged at all at this point, let me back off on the encouragement. I never can sustain lengthy encouragement. If you're feeling it all, is anybody feeling encouraged by this so far? Y'all feeling a little bit of freedom maybe? Go do your thing. You know, the old saint said, love God and do whatever you want. That isn't all bad. There's some categories for thought, but as you get some passionate convictions about what your purpose really is and what's really wrong and how deep change really occurs, at least in some fundamental understandings, not something where you can wrap it up and mystery is gone. Mystery will never be gone. But if you get a couple of convictions that can guide you, then with those convictions, just get in there and do something. That, I hope, is encouraging. Now, let me give you the bad part. The bad part is a lot of us have passionate convictions that we aren't even aware of that are deeply wrong, that are ruling our lives as we interact with people. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. A lot of us have, all of us have passionate convictions that interfere with the ones I'm wanting to develop in my life and you're wanting to develop in yours. We have passionate convictions that are wrong, that rule our lives. I call them ruling passions. Ruling passions that go unnoticed in most of our lives as counselors. What I want to deal with tonight is the fact that we need far more than learning how to counsel. Here's the method, here's the technique, here's what to do, here's how to figure this out, here's how to handle it. Far more than training in that, we need to understand what's going on inside of us, the passions that rule us, as we try to do all these good things. How do you feel when a client comes in? How do you feel when your first session or over lunch with a friend, if you're not a professional counselor, just talking with somebody? Somebody brings something up that's very confusing. How do you feel? Can y'all relate to that? Just a deep confidence, thrill of engagement on behalf of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and just the excitement of defeating the principalities and powers in high places, and just the joy of liberation. You don't feel that any more than I do. I feel irritated when people confuse me. So I keep talking until I find something that doesn't confuse me. Then I call that the problem. Isn't that rather common? What goes on inside of you as you talk to people about their lives? You ever spend time identifying your own passions? What you're feeling? Can you imagine if behind your head, you're the counselor, and behind your head there was a large screen, and every feeling and thought that was going on in your mind got projected onto the screen, and the counselee was looking at it. That might hurt your practice. Can you imagine what it'd be on that screen? Can't stand this woman. What am I supposed to do now? My PhD means nothing. I haven't got a clue. I'm so depressed today, I can't help out of her depression. I just yelled at my wife 3 hours ago, and she thinks she's got problems. Folks, I believe it's those passions that are far more damaging to the counseling process than lack of knowledge of technique or theory. That's why this week I'm concerned to talk about the passions that do control us versus the passions that could control us. Counselors tend to ask 4 questions. This will summarize some material, hopefully in a handleable form. When somebody comes in to see you, when you're chatting with somebody about their lives, their problems, their struggles, and you're as other-centered as you know how to be, you're there on behalf of the person, you're not totally consumed with your own struggles, but you really are there wanting to help, I would think that it's a fair, somewhat simplistic summary to say that we tend to ask ourselves 4 questions as we talk with people about their lives. 4 basic, broad questions. The first question we ask is we hope a trainer will tell us, and some of you have come to this advanced seminar hoping we're going to give answers to some of these 4 questions. We're not. Maybe some of them, but that's not our agenda. The first question that I ask, you ask, we all ask, is real basic. What do I do? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to just sit there and you watch me on tape this morning, you watch me again tomorrow, and Dan on Thursday and Friday? And I hope none of you is foolish enough to think that what we're doing is modeling the right thing to do. I'm just showing you the way I do it. And yet we all want to know what to do. Well, do you start off by the first 30 minutes of the first session building empathy? Is that what you do? How do you do that? Well, you look at people and say, huh. Boy, I'll bet you feel, You know, don't go, it's much more. That's this advanced seminar, folks. Let's do it together. Ready? Got it. Week's over, you're fixed. What am I supposed to do? You build empathy by saying things back to people? What kind of questions do I ask? What do I do here? What do I do there? I understand you asking the questions. I do, too. That's the first question we tend to ask. Second question I think we tend to ask is, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's going on inside of this person? And then you hear a lot of theorizing. And do you do what I do? You sit down with a client and you try with all your might to make the client fit your theory. Why? Because you want to know something. What's your passion? To help or to know something? To represent God or to be in charge of something? Some very ungodly ruling passions sneak their way into these 4 questions. What am I supposed to do? All right, all this theorizing. Well, what am I supposed to do? Get practical, for crying out loud. Well, what's wrong? Let me get it. Let me get this theory. Let me figure this out. How does this work? All right, you gave a lecture on homosexuality, and I want to understand that. How does this work in this case? How do we figure this out? Question number 2, what's wrong? Question number 3 that I think we ask is, well, what's supposed to be? What should be? What's normal? What's good? What's a person supposed to look like? What do I do? What's wrong? What should be? Last question I think we tend to ask is, do I have anything powerful to offer at all? Do I have anything powerful to offer? Can I really do anything? Those who ask the question, what do I do, are those who are saying, train me in a method that works. Those who ask the question, what do I do, are very susceptible to getting involved in a class where the focus is training in a method that works. Teach me a method that works and I'll do it. Why? Because I've got a passion within me. I want to know what to do. I want to know a method. Will you please teach me something practical, some principles, some techniques, something I can do. Train me in a method. That's what we're very drawn to. And as we ask the second question, well, what's wrong? What? I got to get this thing now. I got to figure out what's going on beneath the surface of this person's life. I got to understand this now. People who are asking that question are saying, well, give me a model that makes sense. Teach me categories for thinking. Give me a model that makes sense so I can fancy myself a trained counselor. So when my son, referring to a woman, who I read a letter from her today that came Federal Express this morning, or yesterday, and Rachel brought it down. I think a guy I mentioned to you last night whose son, the girlfriend, broke up with him after engagement. I think I mentioned that last night. Well, this morning I got a 9-page letter from the mother. And the mother was telling me, it was a wonderful letter, very warm and concerned. And she wants to help me know more so I can properly diagnose whether her son really is suicidal or not over this. And I find myself saying, boy, when you really want to know that, I'd like to go to a seminar and somebody who can give me, you know, 8 prognostic signs of suicide. Teach me a model that makes sense, that I can understand. There's a place for that. I'm not knocking it. I'm concerned with the passion that oftentimes energizes the desire for the model. Stay with me. It'll make sense by 9 o'clock. Those who were saying, well, what's supposed to be? What's normal? There are people who are saying, teach me an absolute that is true. I want some anchor points. Give me good teaching. I want training and techniques. I want a model that gives me categories for thought. I want absolutes that are true. Teach me those absolutes. The last question, do I have something powerful to offer? Can God do anything through me? Can I counsel? Am I on the right track? People with that question are saying, provide me a community that affirms me. Did you get my little sketch now in my mind? 4 questions. What do I do? Train me in a method that works. Give me techniques. Well, what's wrong? Give me a model that makes sense. Give me categories to think about. Well, what should be? What's normal? Teach me an absolute that's true. Give me good doctrinal teaching. Be biblical. Do I have anything to offer? Provide me a community that affirms me. I want relationship. Folks, most people in counselor training are looking for techniques, categories for thought, good teaching, and relationship. Does that make sense? If I advertised a seminar and said, I'm going to give you all that, would you all come? I would guess you would. I'd go if somebody advertised that. If I believed him, I wouldn't believe him, but I'd go if I did. And I might even delude myself to think he might be able to pull it off so I could go and pretend. I'd like to have a method that works so I know what to do with every person struggling with a sexual disorder. I'd love to know what to do to help a guy with impotent problems, a woman with difficulty in experiencing orgasm. I'd like to know all the proper techniques for that. There's some, and I've read the books, and I know some of them, and I use them, and I'm all for it. I'm all for that. My concern with that is that as I learn these techniques, I think I help people live their lives better. They never find God any better. But they're happier on their way to immaturity. Or if they're unbelievers, they're happier on their way to hell. Then they're more useful to God's purposes because I have a sexual technique that helped the guy become potent. Now I'm all for the technique that helps a guy become potent in a context. If there was a method that works, I'd go to that seminar, I think. If somebody had a model that really made sense, that's why some of you have come to the advance, because you thought that the model we taught in the basic made some sense. Isn't that true? And I think that's fine. My question is, what's the passion beneath it? I'm going to expose that in a few minutes. I'm setting you up. Setting me up. I'd like to have somebody with authority who teaches with real authority get up front and tell me, this is what maturity looks like. This is what we're after. I'd like that. I'd like to have some absolute that I can count on as true. And somebody could take his Bible and just say, look, this is exactly what maturity looks like. We're having a hard time in our generation defining what the gospel is. If we took a debate tonight on lordship salvation, MacArthur's view versus Hodge's view, we'd be split, wouldn't we? There's some that buy this and some that buy that. You know, the gospel is today, we're confused, let alone what maturity is. Who do you know that's mature? Dad's not here tonight. Dad and mother are still under the weather. They're doing a little better. Some of you asked, and I appreciate that, but they're not here tonight, so I can embarrass them without his being here. I asked him a while ago, I said, Dad, are you a mature Christian? You know what mature people do, I think? I think they get very flustered. Dad was like, I don't know. It wasn't false humility. I think it's kind of legitimate confusion. Those that declare, this is maturity, and I have arrived, they're the Pharisees. I want somebody to tell me exactly what maturity is. Now, I think I can tell you in broad categories what maturity is. It's the person that knows God real well. And that wants to know God more than anything else in the world. And faces life very honestly in the pursuit of knowing God. Something like that, but that's not a very absolute boom, boom, boom teaching. And if that seminar was provide me a community that affirms me, and that seminar was going to make me feel really good about myself and my ability to go out and help people, I think I'd go to that. I wonder why. What are the passions beneath the surface that control you? Let me tell you what I believe the core ruling passion is in everybody's life, and then we'll particularize it and draw out four basic passions that I think inflame counselors. That's what I want to do tonight. I want to tell you first what I think is the ruling passion that rules in all of everybody's heart naturally. As believers, we're doing better than this, but naturally, this is what grows out of everybody. And this will surprise no one. It will seem very obvious when I say it. The core passion grows out of the conviction that when the chips are down, we are finally alone. The core passion of the natural, unregenerate heart grows out of the conviction that when the chips are down, when there's a threat, we're really, finally alone. There's nobody who looks after my soul. It's good enough and powerful enough to handle me in my life. Nobody cares as much as I care about certain things. I'm really alone. And out of that core conviction comes the core ruling passion of everybody's soul, and it's real simple to say, but I believe this is the core issue in each of our hearts, and it's this. I will look after myself. It's real simple. Oh, folks, can I tell you how disturbed I am by the focus these days on the philosophy of taking care of yourself? Can I tell you how disturbed I am by the philosophy that basically says you've got to exercise self-care more and more and more? Is there a place for self-care? Of course there is. Is there a legitimate version of self-care? Sure there is. When you're real tired, take a nap. Brush your teeth and establish your boundaries. And I'm for all that sort of thing. There's a place to just look after yourself. And there's a place for me in a week like this to say, I don't want to talk to anybody else. I'm going to my room and locking the door. I think there's a place for me doing that. Who am I doing that for? Is that other-centeredness? I don't much care. I'm forgiven, you know. I think there's a place for me just locking myself in my room for a while. I don't have any problem with that. Rachel and I, we have a very busy home, and some time ago, we just had too many people. And we had friends that put a note on our door. Nobody's welcome for 1 week. I think that's great. I'm all for it. I don't want to knock philosophy of self-care in terms of those kind of things. But what I want to say is that we're getting so caught up with having to take care of ourselves that we've forgotten that the wasp is what has developed in our souls ever since the tree was eaten back in the garden. I'm going to arrange for my well-being. That's my bottom line commitment. Why? Because there's nobody good enough for me to trust with my well-being, so I'm going to look after me. That's the core agenda of each of our souls. And let me tell you what happens when you have that. Let me tell you how I think it works. At the very core of my soul, the disease I've inherited from my first parents, Adam and Eve, the basic disease that has infected every human being ever since Adam and Eve, except one, everyone except one, the basic disease is essentially this. I doubt God. That's the disease. Why do we not rest when bad things come? Why do we lose our peace when we hear bad news? Well, we're not sure if God's all that good. Does he look all that good? A lot of times, no. He doesn't look good at all sometimes. Seems to me a loving father should do better than he does a lot of times. I'm not terribly persuaded of his goodness. And that's a disease which comes naturally to me because I'm a child of Adam and Eve, and they doubted God's goodness. And when you doubt God, what do? You turn to others and you say, I need you. Underline need. I need somebody around here to do something for me that satisfies my soul. Without God, I've got to look after my soul, but because no man's sufficient for himself, I've got to get you to cooperate. I'm not sure about you, God, because you let this happen, and you let me go through this when I was a kid, and you let this bad thing happen, and you allowed me to be built with this particular problem, and you allowed this struggle to come into my life, and you took away that situation that I wanted so much, and you allowed this problem to come into my family. Lord, you know I couldn't handle that. You promised I'd never get what I couldn't handle. Well, I can't handle that. I'm not sure about your goodness, but I need something. Well, I can't turn to you anymore, so you. Son, daughter, husband, wife, parent, friend, pastor, somebody. Do what only God can do, but you do it now. I need you. And as soon as I require you to do for me what I believe needs doing, because I'm not sure about God, how do I end up feeling towards you? What am I asking you to do? The fallen structure of the human personality is what I'm drawing here. Here's the core wasp, the core ruling passion that leads to all these problems. I'm not sure about God, so somebody has to come through. Son, couldn't you handle things this way, for goodness sakes? I need you to do that. And you just don't do it. Doggone it, I hate you. I hate somebody, because you won't do what needs to be done. I hate you for not being what you ought to be in the middle of my crisis. I hate you. I'll find somebody to blame. But where does that get me? I'm now even more alone than ever. Now I'm totally alone. Everybody's hated. Nobody's coming through for me. God, I'm not sure about him. I need you. You let me down, so I'm totally by myself. Now this is a dilemma. Ah, I got it. I know what I'll do. I'll hate me. I'm the problem. Good. Now maybe I can solve it. It's because I act in this way. If I acted differently, then the other people would cooperate. I can see why my son doesn't do this, because I do such and such. Am I wrong? Oh, I'm a terrible parent. I'll go to parenting classes. I'll improve my parenting skills. And we go, oh man, we as parents get so caught up in that junk. Man, do we get caught up in that. How does any kid come anywhere as close to being normal given who they're stuck with for parents? Well, the news is nobody does get anywhere as close to normal. It's all of God. I hate me. I'm just a mess. Well, I'll work on it. I don't know what to do. Doggone it. I've got to live somehow, so I will survive. I'm going to do something to make it in this lousy world. I'm going to survive. How am I going to do that? Oh, you know what? I found out that when I do this, something good happens. When I tell jokes, people laugh and I feel better. When I get real stern, I can intimidate my friends and they shape up in certain ways. Ha! That works. And out of that comes your style of relating. I doubt God. I need you. I hate you. I hate me. But I'll survive. Here's how I'm going to relate. I found something that works, something that keeps me from being disrupted. I'm a friendly guy. I know how to pull off my ministry. I know how to get strokes. You know, one of the major causes of immorality among the pastoral community is the strokes that we get, the leadership community. When I was at Dallas Pastor Seminar a month or so ago, Rachel and I rode down the elevator in the hotel we were staying to get picked up and go over to the seminar. And there's a pastor and his wife were in the elevator. We started chatting, and he said to me, he said, is it just inevitable that I'm going to fall morally too? That's on a lot of pastors and Christian leaders' minds generally. I think one of the reasons why there's so many struggles in the pastoral community is we elevate pastors to absurd heights and give them so many strokes. You understand that the strokes that I get from teaching a seminar like this is very dangerous to my soul? Don't hold back the encouragement. But there's a danger. You know what the danger is? I can trade on that, and I can stop looking at how I deeply affect my wife. And then internally, I can kind of justify, well, she just, you know, and well, these people know me well, you know. I mean, it just boggles my mind when some people, oh, this sounds so presumptuous, forgive me for saying this, but it boggles my mind when some people say, oh, if I could only have 5 minutes with you. Because the people that know me well don't much care about having 5 minutes with me. Oh, there's a certain illusion that comes from having a microphone on and sitting up front. I've been given some public gifts. Oh, folks, I'm privately to mess like every one of the rest of you. Am I a good counselor? Yeah, I've been gifted for that. And yeah, sometimes 5 minutes to me does help. I'm pretty good at what I do. But I'll tell you, the minute I start living off that, I'm in big trouble. There's a structure to the human soul that's just a mess. And that structure begins with a ruling passion in each of our hearts. I doubt God, and on the basis of doubting God, I'm going to find some way to look after myself. You come through, you didn't, I hate you. Now, well, I can't do that because I'm alone, so maybe it's me, I'll try to improve. I'm going to do something to make my world work because I've got to look after my well-being. That's absolute priority. I've got to arrange my world according to my taste. Now, that's your fundamental ruling passion, apart from the work of the Spirit of God. Now my question is, how does that get expressed in the life of a counselor? We'll look at that after a break. What do I do? Very concerned to learn models that yield categories. What's wrong? How can I figure out what's happening inside this person that's a mess? Most folks who are interested in counseling are looking for some kind of basic absolutes, some good teaching around which they can organize their thinking. And lastly, they're concerned to be in some kind of a community where they're affirmed, simply because, at least partly because, counseling is a very draining, challenging kind of a situation to be in. What I really want you to hear me say is I'm offering no criticism at all of a desire to learn methods or models or basic absolutes or being affirmed in community. I'm for all that. A lot of my teaching has been along that line and teaching models and coming up with categories. What I'm concerned with is that as we try to figure out techniques of counseling and models for counseling and absolutes about what maturity looks like and try to get in community where we get affirmed and learn how to be supported in the middle of all these struggles, I think it's very, very common for certain passions that grow out of this core ruling passion to somehow look after our own well-being, that it's very possible for that core ruling passion to give rise to a variety of other energies, other desires, other passions that corrupt our looking for techniques and models and absolutes and relationships. Okay? And I want to talk about four passions that Dan is going to elaborate on tomorrow night to some degree. Four passions that I think are very much involved in each of our lives as we seek to counsel. And I would suggest that this is something that you want to ponder pretty heavily. And some of this will be very obvious and some will be fairly subtle. So stay with me and see if we can make sense out of the next few minutes. The first passion I want to talk about that I believe often inflames that question, well, what do I do? Is a passion that sounds initially incredibly legitimate. But I think it has some real corruption in it. And it's the passion to heal or to help. As you're sitting down, as your primary passion, as you're sitting down with somebody who's struggling, who's hurting, who's troubled, is your primary passion to heal, is your primary passion to be of help? Are you sitting there as you work with the individual, as they make known their problems, making it your number one priority, making an urgent pressure within you, I've got to find some way to be helpful to this individual? Is that the core energy within you? It sure is within me a lot of times. And it feels very noble. It feels very compassionate. It feels like, I really want to help this person. This is awful. I want this person to be out of their misery. I want to help this person. If there's any way to heal this person, I want to heal them. Let me tell you where I think this passion in its corrupt form, and there's a good form of it, of course. Let me tell you where I think this passion in its corrupt form arises from. And we're just thinking out loud here. This is hardly meant to be definitive, but suggestive and maybe provocative. I would suggest that when you sit down with another individual and you feel a pressure to do something helpful, that pressure is ultimately a very self-centered pressure that arises from a fear of immobility. That's the word I want you to put in there. Arises from a fear of immobility. Let me tell you what I mean. Do you ever fear that you're going to be in a situation where nobody's going to be able to help you? Do you ever fear something might come in your life and no one's going to have an answer for it? Ever been in a situation where you've thought about who you want to talk to and you're just, you kind of sag inside as you think about talking to that person because you know there's just not the help that you want? And there's a certain fear of immobility that I'm going to face something in my life where I'm not going to know what to do. And it fuels a passion that I must believe that no matter what comes up, there's some way to help. Because if I ever get in a similar situation, I know I want to be helped. When problems strike close to home, that's when you can realize what I'm talking about. What a difference in counseling with somebody you don't know versus somebody you love very deeply for long-term natural reasons, like a relative, a spouse, son, daughter, somebody you really care about. Your theories take on a certain anxiety at that point. I can recall years ago when our boys were little, and one time when Kenny was about 7, 6, 7, 8, he got a real high fever. He was up at 100, and I don't know what it was, but it was way too high. And it got so high, he went delirious. And he just started talking, making no sense, just kind of jabbering. And he was a jabber from the day he was born, but didn't make a lot of sense a lot of time either. But this was different. And I remember just running to the phone. I had to get a doctor. There had to be something that somebody could do to make a difference in this kid's life, because I cared about this kid, and I care about this kid. I wanted some doctor, somebody who knew what he was doing, to tell me, put him in a tub of ice or put hot cold compresses or get him to the hospital or give him a shot. There's got to be something to do because I can't tolerate the thought that something's going to come up in my life and it's not going to be able to be solved. I'm terrified of being immobilized. And I wonder if that fear of immobility sometimes generates a passion to help you. That's ultimately very, very self-centered. If that's the passion beneath some degree, at least, beneath my desire to help you as we counsel. As I sit and talk to Ken, you heard this morning, I made the comments and I meant what I said when Ken was talking about what it's like to feel so spent and to want so much to have a response from another. My wife's sitting back there and she'd tell you, I've heard her say this publicly before, that when people have said, what is it that Larry wants from you more than anything else? And the thing that we've talked about a lot, what I want from her is tenderness. I want to languish in the hot tub of my wife's tenderness. I want to be nourished. All those words that I was jumping on Ken for. Or setting him up for the next session, you know. You thought I looked gentle, right? And there's something in me. I remember as I was talking to Ken, and I watched the tape this morning, and I can recall a session probably a year ago by now, I guess, or I'm not sure when it was, but some months ago at least. And I can remember as Ken was talking, saying, I feel that way too. And I remember internally saying to myself, I really want to help this couple because I want to believe there's hope for me so I can have everything I want too. Sometimes the passion to heal and to help others is a very self-centered passion that arises from a fear of immobility. You know what it leads to? It leads to a demand for pragmatism. One of the words that I think I hate most in the English language is the word, or two words, a phrase, be practical. Because what is usually meant, not always, the words can be good, what is usually meant by be practical is find some way to walk around the need for trust. Be practical. Tell me what to do. And if the response is, be guided by the Spirit, oh, come on, be practical. I mean, I believe that, of course, but now what does that mean? We all believe in the Spirit, but come on now, be practical. Tell me how to handle this. There's a real demand for pragmatism. What do I do? Tell me what to do, because I want to help people. Because I'm terrified that maybe someone's not going to know what to do for me, so I want to have some practical steps. Why do you suppose the step mentality has pretty well consumed the evangelical culture? I mean, there's steps to everything these days. The 12-step model, of course, is very popular, and I think God has used that in a variety of ways. I don't think it's all bad. I'm not knocking it wholesale. But I'm arguing that beneath the popularity of the 12-step movement and the step movement in generality, you know, 5 steps to financial freedom and 6 steps to better self-image and all that sort of a thing, while there's some merit and some helpfulness to a lot of that material, there's a certain energy beneath it that basically says, I want something very practical, very doable, that I can bring down under my control so I can make it happen. I want to short-circuit the need for radical trust. Because frankly, God is not all that trustworthy, because I've tried him out a whole lot. And he hadn't done all that much in terms of what I really want him to do, so let's get practical. And when you demand pragmatism or be practical, that results, I suggest, in a method mentality. That results in a method mentality. Results in a method mentality. A focus on technique. Teach me methods. That takes us away from something. When you think of counseling primarily as, well, what do I do? Give me a method. Show me what to do. I want to help this person. What do I do to help this person? I mean, do I just listen better? Is that the way how you help people? Well, then teach me how to listen well. Do you kind of cock your head this way? Do you lean forward? What do you do? Teach me how to help people. And my thought is, wait a minute, you're missing the whole thing. Because if your method mentality kind of overtakes you, that's going to take you away from what really is the center of life. It's going to take you away from the center of life. What's that? Relationships. It results in a method mentality that takes us away from the center of life, which is relationships. No marriage has ever been put together by following steps. No parent has ever become effective with his child by following steps. I mentioned, I think, just a few minutes ago, did I? That Dad and I were on radio last Friday. And in the course of that radio show, on Moody Radio, we were sitting in the studio in Denver, and Chicago called, and I pressed the buttons and did it all right. And in the course of that radio show, I told a story as Andrea, the interviewer, was talking about our relationship with Dad and myself. And I told the story of the time when I was an 8-year-old kid and backed the car out, Dad's new car, and scratched it, you know. And Andrea made the comment. Did I mention this last night? Andrea made the comment in the course of talking about how Dad handled that. When I rammed the car into the side of the garage and scratched up his brand new car, he had it like 2 days when I scratched it. And Dad handled that rather poorly, actually. He made an inappropriate noise, and it wasn't real kindly disposed toward me. And after he did that, it was just kind of an impulsive, quick thing. I kind of ran to the side of the garage with this 1953 green Ford, and he was so proud of this new car, his first new car in a long time, and I scratched it second day, had it. And I think what I'd do would be a whole lot more than what Dad did, but he kind of yelled a little bit. And I remember feeling crushed. I remember just feeling crushed. And as we drove to school, Dad got in the driver's seat, of course, and I can visualize it in my mind. I sat in the passenger seat just like this. And Dad felt real bad, and he was trying to make up. And he was moving toward me, "Son, I'm sorry. I should not have yelled that way. You know, I punished him the whole way to school. Just, you know, Dad handled it very well, I think. He didn't try to make up in some bad sense, but he said, I was very wrong. And Andrea asked a very interesting question. The question she asked was this: where did you get a heart like that as a parent? Back in your day, you didn't have all those 20,000 books on child training. And I felt like jumping in, I didn't let that answer the question. What I wanted to say was, that's why he had the heart. All those books do is give you, most of them, and there's exceptions, but a lot of what the books do is just frustrate you and make you try to play by a certain code external to yourself so you never release your good heart toward your kid. Try to do it all right. I want to help my kid. Give me the right way to do it. Teach me how to do it. Well, Dad didn't read the books on that. And he didn't even have a father. His dad died when he was 5. Did he do everything right as a dad? No, he made a lot of mistakes. Some pretty serious mistakes too, I believe. Like I've made toward my kids, but he's a good pop. You know why? Because I think he understood a little bit about the center of life. What matters is relationships. He wasn't caught up in pragmatism. I don't think his demand was to help. Now, the biggest favor you can do for your kids, most of you as Christian parents, this is to me very much, learn to care a little bit less about them. Become a little more indifferent. Most of us put our kids in the place of God and require them to be perfect. Or spiritual, or no problems, or something. Man, oh dang, let them alone. I was on radio a while ago with Kevin Lehman, the birth order guy. It was live radio about a year and a half ago. And he said, what's the one thing you'd do differently if you were to do all over again as a parent? And I said, I spend less time with my kids. Never forget the look on Kevin's face. Well, let's break for a commercial right now. That's the biggest mistake I made. I spend too much time with my kids. You know why? I wanted to figure out how to do it right. In the process, you lose relationship because you're doing it right all the time. When you're trying to do it right, you never do. But I wanted to help my kids, and I wanted to make them, know that I loved them, and know this, and know that, and I'm going to make it happen. And boy, that one ball game I wouldn't be at. Yes, sir. What a pop. Well, the pressure we put on our kids. I want to figure it all out. And so I miss the center of relationship. And when you do that, we yield to the temptation of every fallen person, which is to reduce mystery. We all hate mystery. Because mystery puts us out of control. I want to analyze things to death. When I hear about a problem in my family, I want to figure it all out so I know what to do. And in most cases, you really ought to just back off and pray. Now, there's things to do and to move, and I know there's times to intervene, and when's the right time? Who knows? Nobody has a clue. You pray, you trust. That's all the basics. And when your passion is to heal and to help, arising from a fear of immobility, leading to a demand for pragmatism, for getting practical, and when it results in, a method mentality that takes us away from the center of a life relationship, what happens is we begin to reduce. And this will sound very general, so you put your own content to it. We begin to reduce the mystery of life and replace it with a method to live. There's a mystery to being a good parent. There's a mystery to being a good friend. And the mystery cannot be reduced to principles. But we try to reduce it to a method and say X, Y, and Z. And you know what was worse? We go to the Bible and try to make the Bible conform to our demand for a method. And then we go to all the biblical principles and reduce them to techniques to satisfy our lust for pragmatism. And the mystery is gone. Have you noticed how non-specific most biblical principles are? Have you noticed how most of the issues in life that you face don't have a specific biblical direction. If you're considering having an affair, I can point to a verse. But if you're having a certain tension that you can't identify its cause with your spouse or your friend, we'll make it your spouse for the moment, and I point you to Ephesians 5, you're going to get very angry with the Bible because all it says is things like, love your wife as Christ loved the church. My question is, but what does that mean right now? And then all the seminar leaders come along and reduce the mystery to a method and get a following. And trust is not required. Mystery's gone, and all that's required is to follow the principles, and now there's a code external to us, and the indwelling Holy Spirit has very little function. As you sit down to help people, as you go to your counseling training seminars like this one, others you go to, and the books that you read, and the supervision that you get, and when you ask your supervisor, well, here's a case, I'm not sure what to do when a person does such and such. I watched Larry counsel on the video screen this morning, and I saw how he was picking up that Joan wasn't quite as excited about that moment on the balcony as Ken was, but he didn't do much with it. Aha! I think I know what to do now. The proper method is, don't call attention to things too quickly. Got it. I'm going to give an illustration of another case where I call attention to things right away. And you go, wait a minute. And you say, which is right? My thought is, I don't know. It's kind of what I felt like doing. Do you have to have a method? Can't you just give your heart? What's your passion to help and to heal? Where does it come from? That's the first passion I want to suggest may have some problems behind it. Second passion. A passion to explain, to control. One of our professors at CCU, a very bright, bright, bright man named Liam Atchison, he's our dean at our school and teaches in our faculty. He gave a lecture to our students a few weeks ago in which he said that the curse of the modern era is rationalism. That we have understood that using the human mind and using the intelligence that we have been able to accomplish a great many things in the physical sciences and in a number of areas. We can build bridges better now, we can fly airplanes, and we can do brain surgery, and we've been able, by using our minds, by applying our minds to explaining a lot of things, and being able to control what we do as we move into people's lives. And the very natural passion within us is to take our capacity to explain and to control that works so well in the physical sphere and apply it to the personal sphere. We become rationalists in an area where rationalism doesn't work. We want very hard to explain, to control. We try very hard to look at people's problems and difficulties and come up with charts and models and explanations so that we can exercise certain control over what they do. And that arises, I believe, if that's your passion, as you sit down and talk with a person and they tell you that they're having this struggle with depression or loneliness or bad self-image, some of you make the assumption that you can't help them until you figure it out. That's not true. That's not true. Now, I think it's pretty true when it comes to medicine. Mom and Dad went to the doctor today, and I hope the doctor explained and controlled, frankly, as he probed and did all these things to my parents and came up with a diagnosis that I think it's just kind of a common cold, no problems, here's some medication, I think you'll be fine. That's based on a scientific body of data, and I'm grateful for that kind of thing because rationalism works in that sphere. But when your mood is to say, I'm not going to be able to really understand, really help somebody, I'm not going to be able to make the kind of impact God wants me to make until I'm able to explain and control, I think you're making a serious mistake. And you're diverting your energies from the real business of interacting with them in the Spirit of Christ. And that demand to explain, that passion to explain and to be able to control arises, I believe, from a fear of chaos. Oswald Chambers said this, that nobody makes much growth in the Christian life, nobody makes much headway in the Christian life until they realize that life is fundamentally more tragic than orderly? It's a profound thought. Nobody makes much headway in the Christian life until we realize that life is fundamentally more tragic than orderly. G.K. Chesterton, in a wonderful book called The Romance of Orthodoxy, said that we're so committed to figuring out what cannot be figured out that we all go mad, ultimately. And he put it this way in a very poetic form. He said, chess players go mad, poets never do. Does that make sense to you? Do you try to strategize everything? You try to figure it all out? Before you make your phone call to your spouse or your friend or your pastor or your child, you sit down and ponder exactly how to do it? Before you walk into a counseling session, do you do what I was trained to do at University of Illinois? Before every counseling session when I was in training, I had to come up with a 5-page outline for what I was going to do during that hour. At the end of every session, I had to write a 5-page paper on whether I did it, and if I didn't, why not, and what to do next session. Counseling became an incredibly scientific enterprise. I was trained in a very behavioral school. Its philosophy was very behavioristic, and man is reducible to a machine in behaviorism, and you're able just to kind of predict and do and do and do and do. And you go in according to a very scientific procedure. Needed to really predict, needed to control. It arises from a fear of chaos. I don't like chaos, so I try to approach life like a chess player approaches a chess game. I try to anticipate moves. I try to figure out, if I do this, then what? Now, is there a place for that? Sure there is. Make that your bottom line, you'll go mad. Allow yourself to be far more poetic. It's the only way to handle the very nature of existence. Existence is not predictable at its final levels. In the areas that matter the most, you just can't predict. That's why, when I hear about the pastor whose son is in jail, my first question is, what did he do wrong? I've got to explain that. Then I can control it so my kids don't go to jail someday and do something wrong. I hear about this child who has this problem. Aha! What do the parents do? Yes, I got it. Now I can teach it so you can all do this so your child won't be homosexual. Your child won't be bulimic. Your child won't get depressed. We try to figure it all out. There's a passion within us to explain and control that to the degree that it is operating in you as you counsel, you're missing your client and you're quenching the spirit. It arises from a fear of chaos. I won't be able to predict what will happen. And it leads to a demand for orderliness. It leads to a demand for orderliness. An order that doesn't exist. Do you believe, as I believe, that people are far more passionate than propositional? Do you believe that the one who sovereignly controls the entire universe is not a machine but a person? Natural laws, and we live our lives on the basis of natural law, and when I cut up here in the stool, I sat down on the stool because it looks pretty sturdy, and I saw Dan sit on it, he didn't fall, so I figured I won't. There's certain natural laws we all live by, and that's fair, but I want to extend that kind of order down into every sphere of life so I never have to be lost, out of control. There's no harder place to be than being totally out of control when you haven't got a clue what to do. You ever got news about a loved one that's not doing so well and you didn't have a clue what to do? And as soon as you feel that, what do you try to do? Try to find somebody who can tell you what to do. Oh, folks, there's a place for getting counsel. I'm all for counseling, I think. But there's an incredible place when you haven't got a clue as to what you ought to do and you can't figure things out. You can't explain, why is this going on? What's the best thing to do? Should I make a phone call? Should I talk to her this way? Should I talk to him that way? Should I write this letter? Should I handle it this way? And you go nuts. You're a chess player. I wrote a letter on behalf of my older boy who's trying to get into a particular school. He's having a hard time because earlier, when he was having some rebellious times, he had some very poor grades that are coming back to haunt him. And I wrote a letter on his behalf to the school he's trying to get into and used my position. Am I right? Am I wrong? None of us knows. Try to figure it out. You'll go mad. Chess players always do. You must live above the strategy in the romance of life and learn to become a poet, which means to learn to become very intuitive, in other words, spirit-led, about the deep things of life. Fear of chaos that leads to a demand for a level of orderliness that is not there, and that results in a profound love of insight. It results in a love of insight. I love whatever gives the appearance of explaining. Is there a place for explanation? Of course there is. When you start depending on it for your final existence, that's when you're in trouble. It results in a love of insight, a focus on cause-effect and how the soul works and how this happens in the soul and how this takes place and how this then happens over here and how it all comes about. And then this takes place and I say, I think I got it. Then you go into the counseling office and you try to remember it. All right, the person has this problem. Let's say, how's it go? Where are my notes? Hang on just a minute, sir. I'll be right with you. Yes, I got it. Now I'm back in control again. You're not a biblical counselor. You just quenched the Spirit of God. A love of insight, it takes us away from something. The center of relationship, which is what? A lot of words can be put there. My word is connection. Results in a love of insight that takes us away from the center of relationship, which is connection. The center of life is relationship. The center of relationship is really connection. Remember Dan talked about the moment this afternoon when he and Becky were in Austria and they had that moment? Remember how he described it? There was beauty there, not just in the sunset. That was what caught his attention. But he talked about holding hands with Becky. There was a moment of connection. Ken and Joan had a moment of connection that I think had a lot of illegitimacy to it, but there was some sense of connection between Ken and Joan as they stood on the balcony this morning in the tape. And when you are explaining everything and figuring everything out and trying to understand the people you care about, you end up not connecting with them. Terrible mistake. And the tendency to explain and control reduces mystery. We're all committed to reducing mystery. And this reduces the mystery of people. People are fundamentally a mystery. Reduces the mystery of people to a model for prediction. The very first thing I learned in graduate school, in my 5-year graduate career, the very first class that I had, the first lecture I attended, taught by Lloyd Humphreys, a measurement psychologist, and the first thing he said was that anything that exists is quantifiable and can be measured and then predicted. That was the first teaching I got in my 5-year career in my doctoral program. Whatever exists, exists in some quantity, therefore can be measured, and once you can measure it, you can manipulate, you can maneuver, you can predict. In other words, there's no longer a mystery. Why do we all hate mystery so much? Why do we all demand that counseling seminars reduce mystery? I hope this one increases it. Why do we all demand that mystery be reduced? Answer, real simple. So trust is not necessary. So we're back in control. I want a model for prediction. If I do this, will my kid get better? And my answer is, maybe. I think it's a good idea to do this. But you know, I know some parents who did this and their kid got worse. What I'm telling you to do doesn't work all the time. Talking with a good friend, making a decision about his child. And he said, what do you think? And I said, I have an opinion. And I gave him my opinion. I think you ought to do this. This is my opinion. However, if you do this, let me tell you how it might work against you. And I went through a long scenario. If you do this, I think your child might interpret it this way, and she might end up doing X, Y, and Z terrible things. And he said, well, then I shouldn't do that. And I said, well, if you did the other, let me tell you how that might work against you. And you end up going, hi-ya, hi-ya, hi-ya. That's where your fist gets cleansed. And you say, God, why would you put me in a world where I can't rest apart from you? And his answer is, because there's no rest apart from me. I'm going to find it by predicting. Passion number two. Third passion. The passion to be right. If you were in our counseling offices up in Denver, and you could hear some of the conversation in the hallways, you probably wouldn't come for counseling. How'd it go in your last session? Jeez, I don't know. Well, what'd you do? Well, I went this direction. Well, did it think it was right? Maybe. We're very uncomfortable with that. Clients particularly. Can you imagine if your surgeon, I don't have a clue, you know, maybe cut over here 2 inches, that's a good bet, you know. What's that thing here? Let's yank it out. Maybe it's a problem. I don't. No, folks, I hope my surgeon does better than that, but my counselor can't. I've told some audiences before, maybe you're in them when I said this, you know, I keep the name of one man in my desk drawer, and I came very close to calling him a couple of months ago. I come close a number of times. I probably should. Might be an act of repentance if I did, I suppose. A man that who has professional credentials, but they're immaterial to me. A man that when I've met and talked with, I just felt a connection with this guy. Dr. John White, Christian psychiatrist. We met a number of years ago in Chicago, and I've met him once since, and don't know him very well, but I said to him last time I was with him, I said, Dr. White, would you give me your number? If I ever get in real trouble, can I give you a call? He said, yeah, you can. And I've come real close, last couple of months particularly, and maybe I'll do it someday. But you know why? It's not because he's a trained psychiatrist, he knows what he's doing. When I go in for surgery, I want a trained surgeon who knows what he's doing. I don't want my surgeon to be sitting in this lecture. Does that apply to you, doctor? Not when you're doctoring. But it applies to you when you're doctoring the soul. And the reason I'm taken with a guy like John White is he just seems to me to be very deep. He seems to me to be very, very comfortable with mystery. He's willing to think real hard, change his thinking. He's not intolerant. He shifted his positions rather radically on a number of issues having to do with the Holy Spirit in the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure if I agree with him or not. My reaction is, he's deep. I'm not sure if he's right, but I think he's real. There's a passion to be right that can be very, very arrogant that arises from a fear, I would suggest, of vulnerability. It arises out of a fear of vulnerability. I may have to trust somebody rather than follow a plan. None of us wants a person to trust. We want a plan to follow. I don't like being vulnerable. I want to know that I'm right. I don't want to have to get up in front of an audience and say, well, here's my views on counseling, and I think they're in the ballpark. If you want me to be sure of myself about something, I've got to stay with a very few basic essentials. I'm sure about a few things. I believe Christ is God. I believe I'm sinful. I believe the way to heaven is through the cross of Christ. I'm sure of those things. Get me off that, and hey, I'm flexible. I'm flexible in my eschatology. Put a gun to my head, I'll shift. What's your favorite position? Hey, yeah. I have my convictions. But convictions on things like eschatology, they matter to me, but I won't die for them. But a couple of convictions I'd like to think I'd die for. But when it comes to the field of counseling, there's a certain passion within me that wants to know that I'm right while I'm counseling. And what happens when I want to know that I'm right is that means I've got to know that you're wrong. And that means I've got to become very polemical, and I've got to stand up here and say, here's the IBC model. Do you know Jay Adams doesn't agree with that? And then we get polemical and divisive and denominational and campish, and Christ isn't exalted, and we all get into our little cults. There's a fear of vulnerability that leads to an illegitimate demand for certainty. There's a fear of vulnerability which leads to a demand for certainty. And we can be certain about certain things. But the things we want to be certain about, a lot of it we can't be very sure of. I'm not sure the best way to handle my child at certain moments. I'm not sure the best way to approach my wife under certain tensions. I'm not sure the best way to deal with my friend when there are problems between us. I'm not sure. I don't like that. I want to be right. And when I have a demand for certainty, what that results in is dogmatism. then the IBC model gets locked in concrete in my mind, and you violate it, and I'll just think you're a heretic. Only thing I'm committed to in the IBC model is there's four circles, not three, not five. I'm committed to that. That's dogma. You know why? My wife gave me a wedding band on the 20th anniversary with four circles on it. I'm not about to change that. My marriage depends on having four circles, folks, so leave it alone. I'm right. So much of our dogmatism masks our doubts. We don't allow doubt in the Christian community, and therefore we get dogmatic about a variety of things, and therefore we divide into camps. It results in a dogmatic understanding, a focus on defending positions rather than exploring reality. I hope that the rest of our lives as an IBC community, whatever that means, the few folks that work together in the team, one of the reasons I like our team so much is I think we're all pretty committed to pursuing truth. I'm just trying to move toward it, knowing that there's a couple of anchor points, and beyond that, we're exploring. If you went to a basic seminar 5 years ago and one tomorrow, you'd find some differences. You'd find some shifts. People have said to me, I read your earlier books. Have you changed? And the answer is, well, I hope. Well, I'm getting tired of your flexibility. Well, then, don't read anybody but the Bible then, because the Bible doesn't change. Everybody else ought to. If we're growing, it results in dogmatism, a focus on defending positions rather than exploring reality that takes us away from the core requirement of relationship. It results in a dogmatism that takes us away from the core requirement of relationship, which I want to suggest is the courage to trust. It is so hard to trust when somebody that you care about is in trouble. I want to figure it out. I want to be right. I want to explain, control, heal, and help, and be right about it. Man, I want all that. Come on, counselor, trainer, give me all that so I can go into people's lives and make it happen. Yeah, onward, Christian soldiers. That's what I'm going to do. It takes us away from the core requirement, which is courage to trust, not to defend our positions. And what happens then is mystery is reduced. And the mystery that gets reduced when you have a passion to be right is the mystery of revelation. The mystery of revelation is reduced to what? To a mechanism for interpretation. I've said for years, and I believe it more deeply every time I say it, that the core challenge facing people who want to think through biblical counseling, the core challenge is hermeneutics. The core challenge is, how do you go to the text that God has written and exegete, which simply means draw out of the Bible, the revelation of God, and stay with the text until God somehow speaks? Have you ever experienced that kind of thing? What we have done, folks, and if you go to Don's seminar tomorrow, you'll hear something about this. What we have done in our theological training institutions generally is we have committed this error. We've reduced the mystery of revelation to a mechanism for interpretation so we can come out with absolutely airtight theologies. The Bible is written largely in narrative form. We have rearranged the story into a system and call it theology. And it's a mistake. It's a problem. We've become scholastic. Ever had the experience of... And this will sound like you're all going to accuse me now of turning into a neo-Orthodox. I don't think I am. If I understand that position, that's not mine. Ever had the experience of meeting God in the text? Ever had the experience of spending time in the Word in a way that yielded not clarity on your theology, but an encounter with God that changed your life? Remember that day a couple weeks ago I talked about with a wasp? You know what happened after that? I didn't finish the story. After that miserable little critter began walking away, and I got so frustrated until I thought of an illustration I could use in seminars, and it seemed all right. I remember saying to God, God, I've got to know something about you that's true. It doesn't feel like a demand to be right. I got to meet you. I got to know you. I got to understand something that you're saying to me. And I spent the next 2 hours going through the development of thought beginning in Genesis in a way I'm going to talk about tomorrow morning in my devotional a little bit. And after 2 hours, I was flying higher than a kite. Why? Because I had a mechanism for interpretation? No. But there was a mystery of revelation that I put myself in line. I believe I humbled myself. You know what that means? Just face what's true about yourself. That'll do the job. Put myself in line for God to speak, and I believe He spoke. In a way that I'm going to, tomorrow morning in my devotional, teach what's right? I hope not. There's a mystery about it all. But I know this, God longs to speak. And I believe there are principles of interpretation, and I'm all for learning hermeneutics and all that. But don't do that in a way which diminishes the mystery of actually meeting the person of Christ as He makes Himself known in the text. The Emmaus disciples had hearts that burned within them. A whole lot of seminary students in libraries just get heartburn from too much coffee, as opposed to burning because they've met Christ. That's not terribly common in our day. Why? We have a passion to be right. We're going to be biblical counselors and be right. And we can defend it because of this. There it is. Yes, sir. And now we reduce the Church of Jesus Christ to a bunch of legalistic people. The last passion is a passion to belong without shame. I'd like to be in a community. I'd like to belong to somebody where I never have to feel bad about myself. Where I never have to feel bad about myself. I'd like to be in a community where nobody ever disrupts me. I want to be affirmed. I want people just to understand me all the time and never rebuke me. I really want to belong. I want to believe that as I move toward you as a counselor, that there's something inside of me that I have to give, that when I give, it'll be just great. And I don't think that's a bad longing, because I think it's one that can be satisfied, but the way we often try to get it satisfied is to get people just to affirm us and tell us we're great without flaw. Growth requires massive disruption. So many people talk about small groups as requiring safety. I'm not sure if groups ought to be safe. You have to define safety very carefully. There ought to be a safety that there will be no withdrawal of relationship. And there will be movement toward one another, but the love, to use Dan's phrase, must be bold. And that can be pretty tough stuff. But I want to belong without shame so that you affirm me. And when you supervise me and I'm a trainee in counseling, I want you to notice my giftedness and I want you to encourage me all the time. I don't want you to stand in my way. I don't want you to disrupt me. I want you to point out all the good things that I'm doing. And when I do something bad, I want you to explain it away so my bad doing never comes out of something culpable. I don't want you to ever expose that the way I do something that's bad comes out of something despicable about me. I don't want you to ever to expose that. I want to go to counselor training where I'm just affirmed, encouraged. That arises, I suggest, from a fear of isolation. Tremendous fear of being alone. Fear of isolation that I may never be fully wanted. You know one of my great fears? And some of you strengthen it on occasion. I have the fear that if I ever simply said what I want to say, I'd be very boring. That's why I've worked so hard all these years to see to it, as best I can, that I'll say things that will work. Anybody who speaks publicly a lot, and I speak publicly a lot, you get a certain read for your audience. It's not infallible by a long shot, but you kind of know when it's time to throw in a joke. You kind of know when it's time to lighten up, get poignant, pull out a tearjerker story. You know, people are too frivolous. Like file cabinet, tearjerker stories. Ah, number 47, this will work. Folks, can I tell you about something which the Spirit of God brought to my mind? No. That's how we do it. Why? Because we're afraid that if we stood naked, there might be something flawed. Well, good news, there is. That's why the gospel means so much, because I'm in the righteousness of Christ. I'm dressed in his garments. I'm not alone. I'm terrified of it. So I want to find some way to belong where you won't be critical. And that leads to a demand for power over anybody who might reject me. I'm going to find some way to blunt your criticism. I'll get away from you and go to the groups that never would ever consider shaming anybody, because shaming people is what's always been the problem. It leads to a demand for power. I want power over anybody who might hurt me. I'll intimidate them, I'll withdraw from them, I'll humiliate them, I'll cry so they'll feel badly and guilty for having treated me so badly. I'm going to be powerful over you in some way so you never hurt me. And that results, I would suggest, something very predictable here. That results in what? A very self-protective style of relating. That results in a very self-protective style of relating. My fundamental energy now is the energy of the flesh, the energy of the wasp. I'm not moving toward you in love at all. Is that going on inside of me as I counsel? Results in a commitment to other-centered relating, a self-protective, in a self-centered style of relating. Results in self-protection as I relate to people. I focus on how to avoid pain and maximize pleasure. That takes us away from the core value of relationship. It takes us away from the core value of relationship, which is other-centeredness. It takes me away from the core value of relationship. If I'm sitting here as your counselor, and the one thing I'm committed to is not looking bad, not being humiliated, if the one thing I'm committed to is not being exposed as somebody who's not too bright, or somebody who's not too competent, or somebody who, when you know me, you won't like me, if the one thing I'm committed to is seeing to it that when I'm exposed, something bad will happen, if that's what's really happening, it's arising from a fear that it might, a fear of loneliness, a fear of being alone, it's going to make me want to have some power over you in some form, so I'll pull rank, and I'll become a counselor, and you're my client. And I'll become very self-protective as I relate to you as a counselor. There'll be no reckless abandonment as I move into your life. It'll take me away from the very core value which defines the essence of what helps people to change, which is other-centeredness. It's a fancy phrase for love. And it reduces a mystery. It reduces the mystery of relationship to the morality of safety. Reduces the mystery of relationship, the mystery of a God who can look at me and say, you're a mess and I love you to bits. Reduces the mystery of a God who could say to Adam, if Adam would have listened, Adam, your wife sinned. You've had no experience with what I do when people sin. I've got great news for you. Adam should have turned to God in trust. He shouldn't have taken a bite. He should have come to God and said, God, I believe all you've revealed about yourself so far, but now I need to believe there's more to you than I've ever seen. Is there? You know what God would have said? Good news. And Adam didn't turn. So the good news got postponed. And then the Lord came to proclaim good news. There's a mystery to that. I can't figure it out. But I want the morality. I want to do whatever I'm going to call moral, whatever brings me a sense of safety. I'll redefine my problem not as sin, but as wounds, and believe God's a very tender God who cares about healing my wounds. That's what I'll believe. That's safety. The morality of safety can take a lot of forms. If I do all the right things, God will be pleased with me. I will not enter into the mystery of a God who can look at me as I am and still smile. Folks, what are your passions as you move toward people, as you counsel? We got our models, we got our theories, we got our categories, we know to disrupt and entice, and we do all these things. But if our passions are to heal and to help, if our passion is to explain and to control, if our passion is to be right, if our passion is to belong to a community where we never have to hurt, then I suggest that we're going to do a lousy job of counseling. One more minute and we'll be dismissed. It's 9 o'clock, it's 9:02. 9:03, we'll be out of here. Rather than the passion to heal or to help, I want to suggest we need to replace that with a passion to enter somebody else's story. The passion is not to heal and to help fix things, but to enter. Don't heal, enter. Enter their life, enter their story. The passion to explain and control. Oh no. Replace that with the passion to give hope. I'm not sure what's going on, but God is. I can't explain it all. And when you buy into my theory, go to the psychiatrist next door, he'll give you a different one. Read my book and you'll say it's good. Read somebody else's book, you'll say that's good. Then I'll say, but they're opposed. We're a pretty confused bunch. But we can give hope. The passion to be right. Oh no. I don't want to cram my theology down your throat. I want to exalt Christ. That's your passion. Exalt Christ in the middle of your counseling session. Don't have to be right and, well, this is what people should do, and if they do this and X, Y, and Z, things will be fine. We have God in our box, and here's how He works. Oh, no. The passion to exalt our Lord. The passion to strive to belong, to find a community that's safe. Oh, no. Replace that with a passion to finally rest. So when you're counseling, you're not scrambling. You're resting. When you rest, you can speak with authority, wisdom, and power. Father, help us to move in these directions. Without you, there's nothing we can do about it. None of us quite knows how to move from one passion to the other. All of us would like to, I suppose, and if I had another hour to lecture, I'd want to, and people would want me to explain how to make a change. I'm not sure. But that's the direction you're taking us. Help us to trust you for that too. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.